There is a railroad bridge just outside of Syracuse, where I'm from, that crosses over a stretch of highway. It's a very old bridge. It was built before the road that now goes under it. And its height is less than the height of a tractor-trailer truck. So regular cars can pass under it, but huge trucks wouldn't be able to without getting stuck or without a collision. So the city put up signs down the road a ways, announcing that this bridge was ahead and that any vehicle taller than X number of feet wouldn't be able to fit under it and would have to change course. They wouldn't be able to keep going the way that they were going. Even after they did that, several trucks ran into the bridge. So they put more signs, and they put them further out, and they illuminated them with lights so that people would see the message even more clearly. You can't get through. You're going to have to change course. Still, huge vehicles hit the bridge, even despite these signs saying obstacle ahead. It was like the words didn't sink in, or that the drivers looked at the signs and took the words in but thought they must mean something other than what they plainly said. So next, the county painted glow-in-the-dark bars on the bridge itself and illuminated those with flashing lights. And every year, it happens at least once that an oversized vehicle smacks into that bridge. I imagine the folks from the town and the county scratching their heads and asking themselves, well, how many times do we have to say it? Is there some way we could have been clearer? What more could we have done? Jesus has pretty clear instructions for the man in today's gospel. The man asks what he can do to be a part of Jesus' vision for society, the kingdom of God, God's dream for the world. What can he do to be part of bringing that about? And Jesus says, go, sell what you have, and give to the poor. The man finds that he can't do that, and we're told he went away sad, for he had many possessions. He's the only person we know of in the Gospels who was given a personal invitation by Jesus to come and follow him and turned it down. So it's easy to be hard on him for that. But the truth is, these are sharp words from Jesus for many of us, I think. Give away your possessions. I like that word sharp appears in the second reading. This really is something that a lot of us struggle with. Give away all your possessions. So we tend to hear that as Jesus telling us that we have to give away everything we own. And then we probably think one of two things. Either we decide, well, that's much too hard for me, and we walk away like the man does in the gospel. Or else I've noticed that sometimes we bring in other teachers and we start to blend Jesus' wisdom with some from other sources, like sometimes we blend Jesus with maybe Henry David Thoreau, and we start to say, well, he doesn't want us to really give everything up. He just wants us to simplify. It's a personal thing so that we have more happiness. It's a purely individual thing that he's asking of us here. Just simplify so we're happier. Or maybe we confuse Jesus with Marie Kondo of the life-changing magic of tidying up. So Jesus just wants us to take all our stuff, the extra clothes and the spare furniture in the attic, the junk in the garage, and ask ourselves whether it's really bringing us joy. And if it isn't, then just let it go. To be clear, both of those are great life philosophies. I'm not sure they're quite a match with this gospel. The clue for me has to do with the word possessions. You and I read that through our time and place, and we picture somebody who has a lot of things in their life, who has some extra stuff cluttering up his house, as many of us do. Jesus almost certainly would have said to hold on to that kind of possession lightly and to let those kind of things go as much as possible, to cut back as much as possible. But possessions in the Gospel of Mark is a translation of a different word that refers to parcels of land. So saying this fellow had many possessions means that he had multiple large properties and land holdings. It means he belonged to the very wealthy landowner class. And in that time, likely the only way to have amassed that much property would have been to have profited from the labor of poor people, the peasant class, people who could hardly put food on the table. It was to have benefited from a system where the rich kept getting richer and the poor kept getting poorer, where the minimum wage was barely a living wage, and where lands had been taken from people who had worked them or cared for them for years. Sounds familiar. So when Jesus says this man must sell what he has and give to the poor, he's talking about a pretty serious redistribution of wealth and resources. Someone with that kind of money would have been able to really impact society and perhaps even reorganize a piece of it to lift others out of poverty. So Jesus doesn't tell him to take his riches and burn them because money itself is bad. He calls on him to use those resources for the good of others. I remember in the town that I grew up in when I was very young, there was a running joke about the snow plowing in the winter. Most of the city, when there was a snowstorm, would spend most of the next day toiling to shovel ourselves out, to get our sidewalks cleared, to get our cars free. But there was one street where that wasn't true. It was the street that the mayor lived on and several other prominent and wealthy people. That street, we noticed, was always pristine, cleared right away. And as with the snowplow, so with other more important resources, as we know, I expect that that neighborhood also was not a food desert. I expect that there was clean drinking water and responsive, nonviolent policing. I expect the schools were well-funded. I'm sure the kids didn't have to walk far to the bus stop. I'm sure it also wasn't a long walk to a bank or a library or a playground. So there's power behind that. There's a power that makes that happen. And if that can be used to ensure that there are resources for upper middle class communities, that same power could be used to ensure that those resources are there so everyone can have access to them. The liberation theologian Gustavo Gutierrez, a Peruvian priest, says, "The poverty of the poor is not a call to generous relief action, but a demand that we go and build a different social order." The poverty of the poor is not a call to generous relief action, but a demand that we go and build a different social order. So Jesus is calling on the man to be part of that. He calls on all of us to be a part of it. He calls on the man to change course. And in case he didn't get the message the first time, Jesus puts it another way. How difficult it is for someone who has wealth to enter the kingdom of God. So here's another sharp saying, right? But all it means is that in God's dream for the world, there is no such thing as a rich person, because no one has too much and no one has too little. Anything extra has been given away so that everyone has simply enough. Jesus says it even more strongly a third time. It's harder for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. Understandably, this has often been watered down through the years. People have tried to make this saying mean something other than what it plainly says, which is that there is an economic part to the Christian life. Did you see that Jesus adds an extra commandment when he's talking with the man? They're discussing the Ten Commandments, and for a while we stay in the realm of what could be just an individual religious level. And then he throws one in that's extra, that's not among the ten. Do not defraud, a purely economic commandment. Because that part of life mattered to Jesus. And a society in his spirit just can't have a situation described in this gospel, in today's gospel, or in today's newspaper. One where oversized amounts of wealth are in the hands of a few, while the poor struggle to make ends meet, and workers struggle just to have enough. This system is an obstacle in the way to the coming of the kingdom. This model is on a direct collision course with Jesus's teaching. So theologians and preachers have twisted Jesus' words around. Way back in the Middle Ages, some famous preachers tried to claim that the eye of the needle was actually a literal place, a low gate outside Jerusalem, and that camels actually could pass through it. They just had to stoop and walk on their knees. Yeah, good try with that. I imagine Jesus scratching his head and saying, "How could I have been any clearer? How many times do I have to say it? What more could I have done?" There are people who take his message very seriously. I think of the alliance of billionaires who have gotten together and asked to be taxed more highly so that others can simply live. And together they support campaigns for a living wage and other initiatives of economic equality. I like that the young man in this gospel is described as meeting Jesus at the start of a journey, because I think that's where a lot of us are in relation to this passage. We're still learning and trying, wrestling with Jesus' words. We're still on the way. There used to be a group of friends from a church, I think in Pittsburgh, that called themselves the Eye of the Needle Society. And they would meet regularly to talk and reflect on what it meant to be both Christian and well off. And how could they hold those two things in tension? Could they hold them at all? And what was being asked of them? I don't know that they ever landed on a final answer, but I like that they took the question so seriously. I like that they struggled with it. They were like the young man in the story. We can see that he's very respectful of Jesus. He kneels down when he meets him. He calls him by an honorary title, good teacher. He seems to really want to be a disciple. And at the same time, he's hesitant. He's not sure he can do what's required. He's not sure he's ready for a radical step. He's still on the way. And for that, Jesus doesn't get angry. Mark says, he looked at the man and loved him. Makes me think of something Richard Rohr said. He says, think of what happened when you first fell in love. Remember how it was to look into the eyes of your loved one and to see the other person's eyes receiving you, delighting in you, enjoying you, looking at you, making you feel like you and the best you. So to feel Jesus's look, Jesus, our soul's true love. What a powerful thing, melting every barrier that we put in front of our heart. What a beautiful thing, calling us to be the best version of ourselves. It's always a journey. We don't know what happened to the man in this gospel after this interaction, but I like to think that this wasn't the last that Jesus saw of him. I like to think he came around, that God wasn't done with him yet, just as God isn't done with any of us. A lot is in our power. Look at what happened at the height of the pandemic. When our aid checks came to us in the mail, so many people who felt that they had more than enough took it upon themselves to redirect that money to where it should really go. We can all be part of the rearrangement of the world. And there's a particular challenge that Jesus gives to those of us who have much. I know of a church in New York City that was quite well off. It was also the home congregation of a somewhat famous religious scholar at the time that everyone admired. During the Vietnam War, the members wanted to know what they could do, what they specifically could do to hasten the end of suffering and to bring peace. So they asked themselves, should they go to more marches? Should they stage a sit-in? Should they do a write-in campaign to their senators? And they put these questions to this respected professor in their midst. And he said, actually, I think there's something else that you folks specifically can do. And in essence, he had them play a version of that old game, 6 degrees of separation. He had a suspicion that among that circle, in fact, probably just among the members of the board, there was someone who knew a congressperson or a governor or a cabinet member or a presidential advisor. And he was right. It turned out that a board member was a friend of Henry Kissinger. And the most powerful thing that they could do, he advised, might not be to be out there waving protest signs. It might be to do some of the same things that Jesus does here, to use love and friendship and relationships to connect with people, people who are already dear to us and who are listening to us, and to call on them to be the best version of themselves, to call on them to make a change. And we all can do this too. If that can hasten the end of a war, couldn't it also speed up the process of reaching wage justice and regulating corporations and redesigning tax codes? May we all do what we can on the journey and use whatever privilege we have, whatever in our life that's extra, to advocate for others and to help God's kingdom come.